Welcome to The Great Debate, Christianity, Truth or Fiction. This debate is brought to you by the UWA Christian Union and the Atheist Agnostic Society. My name is Tiffany, I'm a Christian, and my role today is to welcome you all here, to introduce our speakers and to explain the format of the debate. Today's debate has arisen out of an approach from the Atheist Agnostic Society to the Christian Union, as well as from discussions between the two speakers. In case you've stumbled in expecting a public meeting, that will be back on next week. It's great to see you all here, whether you're agnostic, atheist, Hindu, Buddhist, a Christian, or practicing any other religion. The aim today is to have an open and honest discussion of the issues surrounding Christianity. University, I think, has got to be the place for this kind of thing because we're encouraged to think for ourselves, to ask the big questions, and to seek wisdom. On that note, I'd like to introduce our two speakers today, Tim Thorburn and Michael Tan. They're sitting around, you'll see them later. Tim is an ex-engineer and a staff worker with the Christian Union, and he will be arguing that Christianity is truth. Michael is from the Atheist Agnostic Society. He's a PhD psychology student, has just started lecturing with the School of Music, and will be arguing that Christianity is fiction. On your way in, you should have got one of these. And that just explains the format of the debate, so I'm just going to take us through that. Tim and Michael will each have 10 minutes to present their case, and we'll ring a warning bell at the 9.5 minute mark. After that, they'll have 5 minutes to reply to the other person's case, and a warning bell will be rung at the 4.5 minute mark. The replies will be followed by the opportunity for you to all ask questions, and the way that will be done is you can write down your question on that space there. Just tick the box whether that question is going to be addressed to Tim or to Michael. Those questions are going to be collected by two students, one from each club. They'll go through the questions and pick out three, and we'll hopefully put those questions to Tim and Michael. The way the answers will work is that the speaker who the question addresses will have about 90 seconds to give an answer, and then there'll be a rapid reply from the other person for another 30 seconds. So that's the format of the debate, and it's time to kick it off. So please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Tim, who will be arguing that Christianity is truth. Thank you.
It's great to be here, and I'm glad that you've come along to join us. Thank you for your interest. And I'm really glad for this opportunity to publicly discuss an issue which I think is really important, and to discuss it in such a friendly and, I suspect, robust manner, Michael. Topic, Christianity, truth or fiction. In some ways I've got the harder gig because I'm arguing a positive. It's always easier to demolish and I go first, but somebody's got to do it. 10 minutes is not very long, only time to sketch a few brief explain a couple of points. So let me start with my understanding of Christianity. Christian beliefs centre on the person of Jesus Christ. It is called Christianity after all. That is, there are events, historical data, and then there's the significance of the events, what we mean by them, how we interpret them. In terms of the events, I think these are the basic events that Christians affirm. Jesus was a real person who lived mostly in Palestine those dates. He taught that the kingdom of God, that is, that the long promised intervention of God in human history to put things right, he taught that that had dawned with him and his actions. He performed many signs and wonders, including bringing people back from the dead. He was crucified and died. He was raised to physical, immortal life. Turn to the significance. What Christians say is that these events constitute a visit of a divine person of Jesus, the Son of God, whose death and resurrection were God's loving intervention into human history to rescue us from the grip of evil and death. Now, I must admit that up front, these are extraordinary claims to make about things that happened in history. But notice the two things are tied together. If the events didn't happen, there's no significance. So we've got to go back to the events and ask, did they happen or are they just fictitious? And for such claims, we need fairly solid evidence. And it seems to me that because these events that we're talking about are claimed to be historical events, they're open to the normal questions and inquiries of history. They're open to public scrutiny, they're open to falsification. Christians aren't asking people to take a step of blind faith. I want to offer two lines of evidence this afternoon, amongst many I could choose, one from non-Christian sources about Jesus and a little bit from Christian sources from the ancient world. Just to clue you into where we are in history, there's a little bit of a timeline of some of the events we know, can date Jesus' birth, if it is true, happened around 5 BC. He began his public ministry about 30, died 33. This is relevant in a minute. There was a fire in Rome that destroyed most of it in 64 AD. 120 AD, a Roman historian called Tacitus wrote in his annals something about that fire. Tacitus was a Roman historian trying to explain what happened in the fire because rumours spread that Nero, the emperor, was responsible. And this is what he wrote. Halfway through the paragraph, to suppress the rumour, he, Nero, falsely charged with the guilt and punished Christians, who were hated for their enormities. Christus, the founder of the name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea in the reign of Tiberius. But the pernicious superstition, repressed for a time, broke out again, not only through Judea, where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome also. Now, he's obviously no admirer of Christianity. He's known as a careful historian who clearly distinguishes between rumours, what people are saying happened, and what he knows actually happened. He reports this as things that actually happened. He's got to explain where these Christians come from. And he gives us some very helpful historical data. There were many Christians in Rome by 64 AD, in fact, well before that. The founder of Christianity was Christus, that is Christ, Jesus. He was executed by Pontius Pilate while Tiberius was emperor. And that whole thing, Jesus and everything else, came out of Judea. That's quite strong evidence. Now, it is true that some people today claim that Jesus is just a myth. He never really existed. And there are books regularly being published claiming that story. They go to press. The press usually picks them up because they love controversy. But it's interesting that, as far as I know, not one of the authors of any of those books is actually an ancient historian. This is what one prominent Australian classics professor at ANU said recently, this year in fact, when asked about this. He said, frankly, I know of no ancient historian who would have a twinge of doubt about the existence of Jesus. Now, he's not saying that you can't look at the arguments of sceptics. He's just saying that all those who actually know about the period reject them as fallacious on historical grounds. Secondly, I'd like to turn to Christian sources. There are some other non-Christian sources, Josephus, Suetonius, the Talmud, Pliny, but I won't go into those at the moment. Christian sources are basically the New Testament. They're our earliest Christian sources, the first part of which were written in 50 AD or earlier. Paul's letter to the Thessalonians and Paul's letter to the Galatians. His letter to the Corinthians was written in 55 AD. Now, I'm going to treat these simply as historical documents. They're part of a library of 27 books that Christians collected. Now, when historians look at ancient documents like this, there's three main questions they ask. One is, how close are they to the source, to the time they're reporting about? Secondly, is the information they're giving sort of incidental and gratuitous, or is it sort of designed to try and win an argument? Because if it's incidental and gratuitous, it's much better and more solid information. And thirdly, what do you know about the authors, their character, their history, their biases? Well, this is what the Apostle Paul, an early Christian, wrote. We know about Paul that he persecuted Christians in the first year of Christianity. He was then converted, immediately started preaching Jesus throughout the world. 1 Thessalonians is a book that is universally regarded by historians as having been written in 50 AD by Paul. There is no real dissension on that at all. And here's a piece of gratuitous information. He reminds the Thessalonians what happened when he came to them a few months earlier. You turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, Jesus, who rescues us from the coming wrath. This is quite early, very close to the time. And Paul's saying, this is what I preached to you. This is what I publicly proclaimed. This is what you believed. It includes things like Jesus is the Son of God, that he was raised, resurrected to life, that he will return again. And he did it in such a way that these Gentile syncretists is what they would have been, because all Gentiles were in those days. That is, you, whatever religious beliefs you took on, you mixed and matched, you added to us. They abandoned all their gods to worship and serve this one God. Now, the way it comes out in this document, it's very difficult to doubt its authenticity as information about what Paul preached and what Christians believed at that point. And we go to another book, 1 Corinthians, written in 55 AD. Paul, the same Paul, writes, if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless and so is your faith. More than that, we're found to be false witnesses about God, for we've testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile, you're still in your sins. Notice how upfront Paul is here. his hard-nosed reality. If Jesus is not raised, Christianity is a hoax. I've actually been perpetrating a fraud. But, he says, Christ has actually been raised. That's what I stake everything on, the first fruits of those who've fallen asleep. He says in the same section, brothers, I want to remind you of the gospel I preached to you. That he's going back 5 years or so to when he first went to Corinth. And he's saying, you know this. This is what I first preached to you. That Christ died for our sins, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day, and that he appeared to Peter, the 12, after that to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Now, why would you add that? Because he's saying to them, you can go and check up. This is only 20 years after the event happened. If you want to, many of them are still alive, go and ask them, see what they saw. And this is a public letter. It's not a private correspondence. It's a letter written to a church to be read by them and other churches and other people, anybody who wants to read it. How could he claim that unless he was thoroughly convinced it was true and proclaimed it as such? And notice he's actually going back to eyewitness accounts and saying, here are people you can check up with. In the same letter, just in case you think that Christianity gradually evolved by Chinese whispers, he talks about Jesus as one Lord Jesus Christ through whom all things came and through whom we live. That is, this Jesus, this guy who was crucified 20 years before, was the creator of the universe. That's an incredible claim to make publicly, unless there was at that time substantial evidence that would convince anybody in the world that it was true. So I think there are some firm conclusions that historians generally make about Christianity in those first 20 years or so. Christians in Jerusalem were claiming things about Jesus so outlandish that Paul the Pharisee tried to destroy it within 1 year of Jesus' death. They must have been saying things like, he is the Messiah who's alive again. By AD 49, Paul's publicly proclaiming Jesus as the Son of God who was crucified and resurrected. Paul gives historical evidence for his belief in Jesus' resurrection. Paul claims Jesus is creator of the universe, and other writers in the New Testament are claiming similar things for Jesus on the basis of being eyewitnesses. Let's turn to the Gospels briefly. The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, were probably written a little bit after those letters of Paul. They're a bit harder to date. They were all written, though, within a generation of Jesus' death and resurrection, so that what they wrote could easily be checked with existing eyewitnesses. At all points where they intersect with Paul, there's agreement. At all points where they intersect with each other, there's agreement, but not conformity. Where they intersect with contemporary history and geography, they fit. The task of history, I take it, is to explain what happened when... I will finish. Thank you.
Okay, please welcome our second speaker, Michael, who will be arguing that Christianity is fiction.
Okay, thanks, guys. It's great to see such a turnout today, for sure. I'm looking forward to today for some time. My task today is to justify why I think the core claims of Christianity are indeed fictional. To begin with, I'll give a brief explanation as to why I think all religions are fictional, before I focus on a few of the claims of Christianity in particular. A religious belief is a set of takings to be true about history and about the nature of reality, usually giving a cosmic significance and focusing on human life. Religious belief is a naturally occurring phenomenon in human culture. This is evident because people all over the world develop their own religions in all cultures independently of each other. And religion, like any other human idea, evolves with time. This is evident. Why is this? The answer is quite obvious. People want to explain their own existence and the world around them. People who can't understand why things happen invoke explanations they can understand. Okay, I'm just going to open my PowerPoint presentation, because I haven't done that. Okay. This is why gods all tend to have human-like characteristics. They have emotions, desires, intentions, they make human decisions and so forth. Yet out of all the thousands of religions and gods people have sincerely and genuinely believed in, everyone here today does not believe in thousands of them. Some of you here might doubt the claims of Islam. Some of you might doubt the claims and the gods of Judaism. Some of you might even doubt the claims of Scientology. Why? Who knows, maybe. And why is this? Why should we be sceptical about religions? And the answer is once again very obvious. We doubt the claims of religions because they make unfounded and false claims about human origins, the nature of life in the universe, the causes of natural disasters, the causes of human conflict, the purpose of mankind, and so on. and they are generally supported by nothing more than hearsay, wishful thinking, ancient documents, anecdotal evidence, and an ignorance of evidence or arguments to the contrary. This set of properties is usually summed up by the word faith. Those religions that have survived modern scientific scrutiny are generally those that make non-falsifiable claims, in other words, those which cannot be disproved, of which Christianity is a good example. In addition, there is no more evidence for Christianity than there is for any other religion. Yet the interesting thing is the unfounded or irrational or false nature of any religion is only clear to you if you're not a believer in that religion. If you are a believer, the evidence is everywhere and it all makes perfect sense. So why is this? I can tell you why. Religious belief is not acquired as a result of a sceptical and open investigation, as is, for example, science. It is not a rational conclusion based on established proofs, arguments, or evidence. Rather, religious belief is acquired from authority, and the arguments are formulated and deduced after the belief is acquired. So this allows for an endless series of speculations upon speculations which rationalise the pre-existing belief, which add nothing to the question of whether the belief is true. Let's have a think about the authority by which religious belief is acquired. This authority may have been your parents, it may have been your pastor, it may have been your peers, it may have been the authority of my opponent. It may have also been the authority of a book. Or most likely a combination of all of the above. In fact, using these sorts of authority, you can raise a person to believe in just about anything. So today I'm calling this authority into question. Many a Christian will claim to know of evidence for God or Jesus because they've been told by authority that it exists, yet are quite often unable to produce it when asked. I'll be responding to some of Tim's evidences in my rebuttal time. Here's why I find that Christians are unable to produce evidence. It's because the claims of Christianity are either undetectable, unknowable, or demonstrably false. It is established that prayer does not heal sickness. Angels and demons do not interact in the physical world. Christians are not better behaved than Christians in the same community. Belief in God is not required to live a happy, fulfilled, or moral life. There's not even any evidence for the existence of anything unique or special about human life, such as a soul. In fact, we have never shown that human attributes of emotion, intention, or consciousness, or intelligence exist anywhere outside of the human brain. We have been trying to find evidence for thousands of years and are still empty-handed. So it seems that the influence of God and his associates are nowhere to be found, except in literature and in our imaginations. So in addition to the lack of evidence, there are also serious internal consistencies in the Christian position, such as those of the alleged character and attributes of God. There are also many logical impossibilities about the physical nature of God. I don't have time to expand on these, but I will pick a couple of examples relevant to mainstream Christianity. There's the problem of God's role as a judge in human affairs. Now, as I alluded to earlier, there is no evidence that any form of an afterlife exists, let alone one containing sensations such as pleasure or pain. In addition to the lack of evidence, there are internal problems with the claim. For example, there are no valid explanations as to how a God can justify judgment on a person for an involuntary response, such as lusting after a woman or lacking a belief in God. Take myself as an example. For reasons outside my control, I was born. I don't have belief in God. I don't accept the notion that a loving God exists, nor that I require forgiveness for any kind of sin. And many of you will believe that I will be punished for that when I die. And despite disbelief hardly being, disbelief in a being whose existence I cannot test, hardly warranting a criminal conviction, I would invite those of you who believe this is good justice to run our courtrooms in this fashion. If the defendant truly believes he or she has been forgiven, then we should not only let them free but reward them simply because the judge allows it. This system of justice, I submit, is monstrous. Let's have a quick look at the problem of suffering. Nature is cruel. You only have to watch a cat play with a mouse to know that life shows no mercy. Evolution is a horrible and clumsy means by which the complexity of life gradually increases and by which we all stand here today. It requires death and incomprehensible suffering. It is no wonder that many Christians reject this theory, since an all-knowing, all-powerful God who can create a universe and bear a perfect son should have had no problem in creating humans in a not-so-clumsy and cruel fashion, perhaps just as Genesis suggests. And the next time we read of poverty in India, genocide in Africa, tuberculosis in Asia, child prostitution in Eastern Europe, or even we visit the local cancer ward at PMH, we must ask ourselves, is this really the outcome of a planned design of a perfect and loving God, or does it merely reflect the indifferent nature of life and a struggle for biological survival? I will now discuss the alleged authority that is the Bible. I would like to make the point clear there is nothing in the Bible that could not have been written by pre-first century civilizations, nothing indicative of supernatural intelligence. There are no specific prophecies that have been fulfilled, no previously unknown scientific knowledge. If anyone believes there are, you are wrong, and I invite you to investigate it properly so you can learn this for yourself. Now, the Old Testament contains a variety of stories such as seven-day creation, Adam and Eve, a global flood, Noah's Ark, stories which have long been disproved by science. As a result, modern Christians are generally forced to acknowledge that the Bible must have been written using metaphors, and they invoke them where they see fit. Yet when we come to the alleged life of Jesus, as described in the New Testament, most Christians will not view the story as a metaphor. Here we have a story about a human who was supposedly the son of a god. He was allegedly a perfect character, performed miracles, cured diseases, arose from the dead, and so on. Are these attributes consistent with the way in which we can observe the world to operate? No. In our experience, virgins do not give birth, water does not turn into wine, and bread does not produce more bread, no matter how much we might want it to happen. Now, this does not rule out the possibility of such things occurring, but such extraordinary claims do require extraordinary evidence, as Tim has made clear. Yet there is zero contemporary evidence for even a character named Jesus, let alone the miraculous deeds in which he is written to have performed. The Gospels were written about 50 years after Jesus' death, as Tim has mentioned. We do not know for sure who wrote them, since the earliest surviving fragments we have date back to a century after Jesus' alleged death. The alternative I propose is that the story is nothing more than allegorical literature, that is, fictional. In contrast to the Christian position, this proposal is entirely consistent with what we know about the world, the way in which the world operates. No faith is required. We know people make things up and misinterpret events. We know human communication is unreliable, especially via word of mouth. We know that ancient civilizations all invented gods. We know people believed in and still believe in these false gods. We know that religious belief is usually acquired in a very unreliable manner. And we know that institutions are capable of misleading entire populations, including the educated and elite. And we should all know from our own experience that our personal beliefs can be wrong. Why should you as a Christian escape these criteria? Ask yourself, what is more plausible? The creator of the entire universe having a perfect son in a pre-scientific civilization of ancient Israel somewhere in the Milky Way galaxy, and this son had the ability to circumvent the laws of nature and physics, or that the same pre-scientific, mostly illiterate first century Israelites, on the verge of a cultural revolution, made errors in judgment in believing allegorical writings as truth? The evidence produced for Christianity does not meet the burden of proof required to validate the divinity or even the existence of Jesus. In contrast, there are good reasons why such a story would have been written as allegory and believed as truth. So I believe I'm justified in saying that Christianity and the story of Jesus is most likely fictional. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. I'm now going to invite Tim to come back and give a reply to what he said.
Thanks, Michael. Michael has raised a few arguments, most of them about religion in general and a few about Christianity. I'll just make a couple of comments about the religion in general because that wasn't my main point. My point was about Christianity. His arguments, I think, amount to what you could call a nothing buttery argument. That is, if you can demonstrate a few possibilities where people made up religion, at least that's our conviction about it, that means all religions are like that. Now, as a matter of logic, that simply doesn't work. Try it on anything else you like. I'm sure you can find at least 150 people in this room who've never been to a West Coast Eagles game. But does that mean no one ever goes? No, it's a nothing buttery argument. And so the only way to deal with Christianity as I've presented it is to look at Christianity itself. That is, what is the evidence for it? What is the evidence for Jesus? Because unlike what Michael said, as I've demonstrated to you, the early Christians did not rely on any authority. The Apostle Paul, when he rocked into Thessalonica, had no authority amongst the people there, particularly the Gentiles. He was just a funny Jew who they would have despised, with a message that seemed stupid. Paul acknowledges that many times, that on face value, his message of a crucified king in that world made no sense whatsoever. But they were convinced not by his authority, but by the testimony of historical evidence, by the eyewitness accounts, by the proclamation and the way it fitted together and made sense for them and their world. So now, it may be that from then some people have accepted things by authority, and I'm with Michael in saying, please don't. Don't believe things just because people tell you. Investigate it yourself, think about it. And in that regard, can I encourage you to investigate Christianity properly? The easiest way to do it is to read one of the biographies of Jesus. Most of the people I meet around this university have never read one as an adult. They've got some vague idea of what it used to be, please read it for yourself. We have some copies there. They're free. Please take one of either John's biography or Mark's biography. Have a read. See what you think of it. Because I think when you read it as a document that comes out of history, when you know that it was certainly written within the generation of Jesus' death and resurrection, while people were still alive to confute it if it was wrong, it bears up brilliantly as a historical document. So going on to the Bible, Michael claims that there's nothing in the Bible that contains, for example, any predictions. That seems very hard to square with what we have in the Old Testament, which seems to have many predictions of God intervening in human history in the person that became known as the Messiah. Were they written before Jesus came on the scene? They certainly were. We've got lots of evidence for that, including the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were dug up in 1947, where we've got scrolls of some of those books themselves which date from before Jesus. So there's no doubt it came before Jesus. And they make some very detailed predictions about the Messiah, what he would do, and where he would come from. And Jesus fits those, although in a surprising way. He asks, why do Christians take some things as metaphor and some as historical? The reason is because when you read the books, like any literature, it gives you clues as to which way to take it. So again, I invite you, read the Bible, read some of those biographies of Jesus and ask yourself, are these metaphor or are they trying to tell you some things that really happened? I'm sure your own judgment, as mine is that they're things they're saying and believed sincerely really happened. He talks about virgin births and other such things that don't fit our world, including resurrections. Let me just, if I can, I need my PowerPoint now. He's following an argument by David Hume at this point. Can you see that? This is basically Hume's argument. If persons report witnessing the occurrence of an event which is outside our experience of the world, then it is always more likely that the reports are wrong than the event occurred. I think that's a fair... It's not Hume's words. I think that's a fair summary of his words. He put the argument up in about 1792, I think it was. Philosophers have been dismantling it ever since, fairly thoroughly, for lots of reasons. It's circular, it's reductionistic, it takes inductive logic too far. But it's actually very unscientific. 30 seconds? It's unscientific because on this basis, when people first returned to England from the settlement here in Perth, and reported that they saw black swans, they should not have been believed ever. Notice it says always more likely. They reported an event which was outside the experience of every person living in England. Does that mean it was itself wrong? No, what it meant was that they should have been sceptical, but they should have listened to the evidence. And gladly they did, and now black swans are accepted. Thank you.
Now Michael's going to come up and give his reply.
Okay, I think anyone who's had a religious versus atheist discussion before will know that you can't always use logic to disprove or prove religion. In many cases, it is impossible to try and corner religion into a logical disproof or vice versa. So what we're trying to do is appeal to your sense of reason, not so much logic. Okay, a few things about what Tim has said about the predictions from the Old Testament to the New Testament. For example, he mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls, in which he evoked, I think, is the book of Isaiah, which was found dating back to before the New Testament, which is fine, but we have to remember these are self-fulfilling prophecies. It's one thing to produce a prophecy, for example, that a volcano will erupt in 20 years' time and kill this many people, and then have that found after the event as the prophecy that will actually be confirmed impartially as to one with which you have a prophecy you can fulfill for the purpose. For example, the people who wrote the New Testament could have very easily written the New Testament to fulfill the prophecies and therefore claim that they are fulfilled and therefore divine prophecies, which is a circular condition. Okay, now, with the writing of the Gospels, that Tim mentioned that we had the Roman historian Tacitus, who wrote his Annals, and I believe it was 116 AD they were written. Okay, I mean to make this clear, this is evidence for Christians, not of Jesus. And this is certainly evidence for the early Christian church, and this is exactly what we would expect if there was to be religion that started to gain momentum around the 2nd century AD and in the late 1st century AD, which is the case. There's no doubt in my mind that the Christian movement has spread wide and far. Certainly here we sit today 2,000 years following, and the majority of us here are most likely Christians. So there's no doubt, in fact, it is exactly what we would expect if the story was fictional as well as if it was true. So it doesn't prove one case either way. Okay. With the professor, I think, what was the professor's name, Tim? The
Graham.
Professor Graham from ANU. Once again, he makes the claim that no ancient historians would doubt the claims that Jesus existed. This is false. This is, if you inserted the word Christian before historian, then you might agree. No ancient Christian historian would doubt that Jesus existed. There are many, many ancient historians who doubt the claims of Jesus existed. In fact, there's a whole school of literature now under the Jesus myth, which makes the case very clear that Jesus was fabricated in the late first century. And in fact, this is also consistent with the Gospel of Paul, as Tim brought up. Paul does not speak of Jesus' life. He does not speak of Jesus as a person on earth. He speaks of Jesus as a vision. So he does not speak of Jesus as the historical character. This was written in the middle of the first century, which was within the generation of Jesus' life. So it provides a perfectly reasonable time frame that the Gospels can then be fabricated afterwards to then superimpose the life of a real person onto a mythical character which Paul spoke of as a vision. Okay, another thing which Tim brought up was setting up, I think it was Paul who mentioned that if he's not a fraud, therefore he must be telling the truth. This is a false dichotomy. You don't have to, if you're not a fraud, it doesn't mean that you're telling the truth. It might be that you're mistaken. So Paul may have very well been mistaken in believing that Jesus was real and not necessarily been a fraud. Just finally, with the closed universe argument, which is the one of David Hume, Tim was right in saying that we should doubt claims which we have not experienced in our lifetimes. For example, if I had not seen a black swan and someone told me they had seen a black swan, I would certainly doubt that. But the burden of proof is clearly on the person who makes the claim to provide me evidence of a black swan. If you claim that Jesus existed or that God exists, you must provide the evidence. You can't just rely on my faith to accept your truth because you tell me you saw it, because we all know that human experience and human perception is flawed. Right, thank you very much.
Okay, well, it's now over to you guys. You can write down questions on your bit of paper. Two people will be walking up and down the aisle, so just hand that to them. Remember to tick the box, whether it's Tim or Michael you want your question addressed to. When the questions are asked, what will happen is that there'll be 2 minutes for a reply to be given, 90 seconds will go to the speaker who the question was addressed to, and 30 seconds for a right of reply. Okay, so while that's all happening, I just want to make two announcements. On Thursday at 12 p.m, there will be an open forum with Tim and Michael in the Law Lecture Theatre, which is the first floor of the Law Faculty. The forum will be more interactive than today, and you'll have another opportunity to ask any questions that didn't get addressed in this session. And also, if you're interested, there are handouts down at the front counter about the Christian Union and the Atheist Agnostic Society. Hello, everyone. We've got our first few questions. And first of all, we'll ask, was it Tim? Michael? It was Michael, sorry. Come up, Michael. The first question I've got is, would you say that logic is somewhat also reason?
Well, logic is about proof. I mean, you can establish a logical proposition which disproves the existence of something. And as I think is perfectly clear to all of us, you can't disprove gods. We can't form a logical proof which is going to disprove it. Even though I could come up with one, it's not going to be accepted. Reason is not as rigid as logic. Reason, you have to appeal to someone's sense of reason. I mean, you can appeal to someone's sense of logic, but logic is somewhat external to human perception, at least in theory.
Do you want to come back
on that? I'll plead ignorance. I reckon they're the same.
Okay, this one's for Tim, so come back, Tim. Why don't you follow other religions such as Islam or Judaism, given that there is also similar historical evidence in thingos for God?
Thank you. Judaism I don't follow because Judaism, as I understand it, is fulfilled by Christianity. That is, all that Judaism promised and was came to its fulfilment in Jesus. He was the fulfilment of all the expectations that God led the people of Israel to have. So I guess I understand them as sort of fellow travellers who rejected Jesus and got left behind in where God was going. Islam's slightly different. Islam claims to be a sort of fellow traveller with Judaism and Christianity, but rejects many of the teachings and beliefs of both, almost entirely on the grounds of revelation that supposedly came to Muhammad and his followers in the 600 AD period. Now, in my understanding, that the evidence for that is not falsifiable, unlike the evidence for Jesus. Where it does intersect with Christian historical evidence, it contradicts Christian historical evidence with no evidence. For example, it says that Jesus never died, but everyone in the first century who mentions Jesus and whether he died agrees that he died. So it seems to me just it doesn't stack up historically.
What we're doing is just pitting one set of beliefs against each other, both of which are equally unfounded. I think it's a sceptical position to take, I think, is you have the burden of proof on the person to make the claim. So if neither Christianity nor Islam can make the claim, then neither should be believed. With regards to Christianity fulfilling the claims of Judaism, you may as well then say that the Book of Mormon fulfilled the claims of Christianity to Joseph Smith in the last century. So I don't think that's a valid argument either.
Stay up here, Michael. One question for you. There's a prophecy in Daniel of how the kingdom of Greece will split into four sub-kingdoms about 200 years-ish before it happened. How is that possible?
Okay. You can get a lot of prophecies and find some that will come true, especially very vague ones like at some point the kingdom of Greece will be split into four kingdoms. How many kingdoms are split into today? More than four? I'm sure. So at some point in time it would have been split into four. Okay, this is not evidence. What we need to do is look at the prophecies as a whole. You can't just select those that came true and said, look, this one came true. What about those that haven't come true? How long do we have to wait for Jesus to come back before we acknowledge that he's not going to? Thank you.
I think it's not quite so easy to dismiss Daniel because four was a particular number and it did happen. It's not just sometime random in history it split into four, but it happened as in the book of Daniel it was the sequence was prophesied of the Medo-Persian kingdom and then the Greek kingdom and then very soon splitting into four, which is what happened under Alexander the Great when he died in 323. That's the end.
One more question for Tim, and then we'll draw it to a close. So by asserting the truth of Christianity, do you deny the truth, what believers of that faith take to be true, of other religions or faiths? For example, the extensive creation myths of Aboriginal people and the Muslims' belief in Muhammad and Allah.
Thank you. I've only talked to one Aboriginal Australian about their creation myths, and he told me they were myths. That is, that in his understanding, they didn't represent a physical reality of any sort. I take him at his word that that's what they mean, but that's not what Christians mean when they talk about Jesus. So I think self-acknowledged they're different. I take it that Muhammad was a fraud, whether he knew it or not.
So once again, we're just really reiterating our beliefs that he's a fraud. I mean, I could say the same thing about anyone I liked and wouldn't necessarily make it so. With regards to the Aboriginal, if you assign a creation myth, then of course it's going to be a myth because you've named it a myth. I could just as easily say the Jesus myth. Does that make it a myth because I say it is? I don't think so. Thank you.
Well, please join me in thanking them again, please. Questions that have been raised from today's debate are, is Christianity different from other religions? The evidence, is it real or is it affected by faith? And is experience the way to judge truth? I think these might be questions that all of us should consider. And if you want to pursue these questions further, there is that forum on Thursday, 12 o'clock, in the Law Lecture Theatre. That's the first floor of the Law Faculty. Hope to see you there. Just a reminder, there are handouts down the front about each of the clubs, so please feel free to take them on the way out. Thank you.